Tis the season. And no, I'm not talking about holiday season. It's campaign season in Maryland with an open race for governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, and comptroller. And of course, we'll be heading into the midterm elections for Congress. And with the recent passage of the president's infrastructure bill, there are plenty of interested parties who want to know what you are thinking and how they can appeal to you. Good day and welcome to the podcast, To Be More. I'm your host, TJ Smith. To be more is exactly what we want. We want to be more than some of the problems that we know exist in our area. As the next election season gets underway, there will be plenty of promises made based on what many of us say is most important to us. And there will be no shortage of polls that give politicians a glimpse into what we are thinking. But how do pollsters do that? They never call me, a famous line you often hear when a poll is released. And some of you may remember the presidential election of 2016 and how polls were called into question. But were they actually wrong? Locally, the Goucher poll is a highly anticipated poll that gives us a glimpse of what Marylanders are thinking on a myriad of topics, from the governor's approval rating to whether we believe Maryland is a northern or southern state. My guest joining me today is Dr. Malia Cromer. She is an associate professor of political science and the director of the Sarah T. Hughes Center for Politics at Goucher College. Dr. Cromer, thank you for joining me today. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thanks so much for having me, TJ.
Well, I tell you one thing. Polling is something that people like to wrestle with because if it is in their favor, they will talk about it all day long. But if it's not something they agree with, they will say the question was asked wrong or I wasn't asked. So I want to use this opportunity to kind of get a little bit more in the weeds so we can explain to people how this all works. So this latest poll that you guys just released from Goucher, it was registered voters. Can you tell me first, is there a difference between registered voters and likely voters?
There is. So let me backtrack really quickly, though. Our polling methodology isn't just registered voters. So the Goucher College poll takes a random sample of Maryland adults. And from that, we screen down to registered voters. And then as we get closer to the election, we'll screen down further to likely voters. So that's really two different ways that pollsters approach getting a sample of the electorate. Some folks like me go from Maryland adults down to registered voters. Other pollsters will do just the registration-based sampling and call just off the voter list. There are pros and cons to both, but because the Goucher College poll is a policy poll first, so we're interested in what all Maryland adults think about the policies that affect their daily lives, we're always going to do Maryland adults. And then when we do our election polling, we will screen down to registered voters. And then again, when we get closer to the election, we'll start to screen by likely voters. And I think that was your next question, right? How do we find likely voters?
Right. Well, yes. And what's important, I think, about that, and thank you for explaining it, is especially as we get to the primary. Right now with the poll, you have a larger swath of people who might not necessarily make it to the polls for the primary, correct? Where the likely, would they be more likely to make it to the polls versus the greater group?
That's right. So the first cut, right, is Maryland adults. So we generate a random sample. And I say we generate, that our survey provider generates a random sample. Now it's primarily cell phones and very few landlines. So if we took a step back 20 years ago, it would obviously be mostly a landline sample. So we're calling a mostly cell phone random sample of Maryland adults. And the next step would be then once you ask them for their party registration, you know, that's going to cut out. So let's say we're doing a Democratic primary. That immediately cuts out everybody but Democrats because we're a closed primary state. And then from there, as we're closer to the election cycle, we're going to add in a series of screening questions, like how interested they are in the election. Did they vote in the last primary election cycle? How much attention have they paid? And basically, what's their likelihood of showing up? And all of those questions together create a screen in which we can try to slim down the folks who are most likely to show up to vote in that upcoming election. Now, again, that is it's an imperfect science. We try. You're relying on people's honesty of whether they're not going to whether they're going to show up or not, and that becomes a problem for pollsters. Figuring out what that electorate is going to look like, best estimating it, is the cause of a lot of headaches for right. people in my industry and for people who consume those polls on the outside.
Right. And Dr. Cromer mentioned a closed primary. So that means if you are a registered Democrat and want to vote for a Republican, you cannot in the state of Maryland in the primary, only in the general election. So we have that methodology down. And as it gets closer, that pool is going to shrink a bit as far as who you're narrowing it down to. Now, that sample size, and that's going to also roll into the margin of error. If you're ever looking at a poll, for those of you listening, it's usually in small print at the bottom. It'll say, 3.9, 4.9, 5.9, plus or minus. Can you explain the sample sizes for a few of your polls? Because I know some of them have been different and you guys use really large sample pools.
Well, so the margin of error is related to sample size, not population size. And so typically, like a random sample of about 700 or 800 respondents is going to have a margin of error of anywhere, like just around like 4%. So what that means for the average consumer of polls is that you take whatever the number is and you add 4% on either, plus or minus. So if the race is between, candidate X and candidate Y, and it's 49-51, nobody's ahead in that race. Both of those candidates fall within the margin of error of each other. And that sort of, sometimes that uncertainty, people don't like it. They want to say who's definitively ahead or definitively behind. But what the margin of error does is it introduces or it demonstrates sort of that uncertainty in the race or uncertainty in the numbers, that it could be anywhere from, so 49 plus four or 49 minus four in terms of where they're actually at. And I think that's important for pollsters and for pollsters to be clear about. And I think it's also important for consumers of polls and the media when they're talking about polls, that they're clear about the margin of error. It's especially important on horse race polling when you're trying to the candidate up or candidate down, for media when they're consuming these polls, to be really crystal clear that once you fall within that margin of error, you cannot tell whether somebody's up or down.
Yeah, so that's good, because let's rewind. I talked about it in the opening to 2016. And there were a ton of polls done, and there are so many different polling outlets out there. 538, I know, ranks polls. I don't know how you feel about them as an outlet to ranking polls, but they rank different polls. But there were so many polls done back in 2016, and there was a narrative that the polling was wrong. But if you look at it, and you are the expert in the polling, I want to know what your thoughts were. Was it Hillary Clinton more on the plus side of the polling when she effectively was on the negative side, and Donald Trump was on the plus side, which was the, that little margin of error that you were talking about? And it wasn't as big of a flop as people think, because he ended up winning, because she actually won the popular vote. So technically she had more votes, and we weren't necessarily counting the electoral college votes. Can you help us understand that a little bit?
Absolutely. And so let me preface this by saying that pollsters are not infallible, and mistakes have certainly been made since 2016. And we can talk about some of those mistakes and what we've done to try to correct for them. So the larger picture in 2016 is that pollsters accurately estimated what the popular vote would look like. So if you look at 538, which does, so some of their models just average what all these sort of publicly available polls are putting out there. So 538 does this, Real Clear Politics does this, at a time back in 2016, Huffington Post did this as well. And so that's the larger picture. So the average of polls accurately showed that Hillary Clinton would win the popular vote. Where things got tricky are the individual statewide polls. And so these statewide polls, like, for example, in Pennsylvania and in Florida and some other states, what the larger picture never captured was that Donald Trump was slowly and steadily cutting into Hillary Clinton's margins persistently up until Election Day. Clearly, the momentum was on his side, particularly in some of those swing states. And what really happened was the margin, like he was starting to cut in to the point where he was within the margin of error, and things broke his way heavily on election night in 2016. He bested the margin in a lot of the different polls, but there was also some clear misses by pollsters. 2016, when we look back to it, a lot of it is because pollsters overestimated the number of college-educated voters in their statewide samples. They were overestimating college-educated voters, and college-educated voters, particularly since 2016, have broke really hard for the Democratic candidate. It gives a Democratic advantage. So that was a problem in 2016. Pollsters tried to correct for that. Now, that is a correction that we made at the Goucher College poll. We started to weight by education to make sure that we were no longer overestimating the number of college-educated voters in our samples. That's a change we made in 2018. The polls were great in 2018. And we can go on and on, like, where the problems lie and what we can see in 2020 as well, if you'd like.
Right. Yeah. So there obviously are some issues. Again, polling generally gives you a glimpse of where things are, and that's going to fluctuate day to day. I mean, something can happen tomorrow that tanks a candidate or that puts a candidate on a path of, you know, they're coasting to victory. And that'll move us right into, like, crosstabs, which are interesting. And people who don't pay attention to polling don't necessarily understand what crosstabs are, but that's where the meat of this data is and how that methodology that you all use comes into play, where you take a state like Maryland and your Goucher poll, and you basically carve it up and cut it out how the shape demographically is made up based on the electorate. So can you kind of get into the crosstabs a bit from the demographics, mm-hmm. the size of the state, the different jurisdictions? So how Baltimore City would be represented in such a poll?
Sure. So I think this is another important thing for consumers of polls to take a look at. Good pollsters or pollsters who are transparent in their methodology are going to provide for you what the demographics of the state look like, as well as what the demographics of their sample looks like, and the demographics of their registered voters look like, or the demographics of their likely voters look like. That should be all upfront for a consumer to easily find. It's on, like, the third or fourth page of our full methodology statement that we release with every single poll. In addition to that, we also release full crosstabs, and that is our results by demographic. And the results by demographic, I think, obviously help us take a closer look at how different types of people think about these different issues. And the underlying message, it's the devil's always in the details, right? What's interesting, and I think it's important to note, so with Baltimore City, if you look at the current population estimates, we make about here in Baltimore City about 10% of all statewide voters. So we're smaller than, you know, smaller than Baltimore County, certainly smaller than Prince George's and Montgomery County. And that clearly has some political ramifications, but it also has sort of ramifications for public opinion polling and things that people are interested in and care about. I'll give you a really good example. A couple years ago, gosh, it's been 4 or 5 years ago, we asked about the red line. We asked about statewide voters if they had heard of the red line. And we know in Baltimore City, the red line was a huge issue here. But when you ask about it statewide, barely anybody had heard of it. and that just demonstrates, I think, when you look at a large statewide sample, if only 10% of the respondents are accurately coming from Baltimore City, these issues that become really important to us, they're localized issues that are at the heart of sort of the transportation debates and social justice debates, sometimes don't resonate to or even show up in a way when you put them to a statewide electorate.
Yeah, and that is certainly reflected in your poll, because I think if you kind of look at maybe what you've heard over the past year, and if you went to Baltimore, maybe Twitter or Baltimore-centric residents, the social justice piece might be a larger issue. Crime, of course, might be a larger issue. But you look at the statewide polling results, the economy ended up being the top issue by far, comparatively speaking. And, you know, that's a good way of putting it, is the, you know, population in Baltimore, comparatively speaking, is different. And I wanted to ask you to define a few terms that were used as we get finished this in the weeds, in-depth look at how this is all put together. You use the terms in this poll, progressives, moderates, and conservatives. Ah. do you have a loose definition of what a progressive is, what a moderate is, what a conservative is? And I have to actually throw these other two in, because this was also used. And it's a reality. It's the reality of where we are. The Trump Republican and the Hogan-type Republican, because you polled and tested on those. And their strong opinions towards those brands. So progressive, moderates, and conservatives to start, and then we're going to Trump and Hogan type Republicans.
Well, let me just say this. You are correct in saying there were certainly strong opinions, and there are certainly huge divisions in opinions, which suggests to me that the average voter has an idea of what those terms mean to them, mm-hmm. that they can distinguish what it means to them. I don't provide for them. I don't say to them on the poll, like, this is what a conservative believes. Are you a conservative? I don't define those issues. People's identity matters. How they identify themselves matters, and how they as individuals view politics matters. What they think a Larry Hogan Republican is most certainly informed by who they believe Larry Hogan has been over the last 6.5 years, and who they believe what a Donald Trump Republican. While it might mean slightly different things to different people, it is clearly among Marylanders, like, that moniker or that attachment to the label, which will matter, by the way, in 2022. It's undeniable that there will be candidates who run as a Larry Hogan Republican and try to pick up that, like, that moniker, or as somebody who's more closely aligned with Donald Trump. What our poll suggests, that doesn't define what those terms are. Our poll suggests that those terms are meaningful. And they're meaningful for average voters. And so when I put mind you, we're a year out from the election. So I tried to frame the election in a way for voters to look at in ways in which the average voter would think or talk about the election. The average voter isn't having some deep conversation about what it actually means to be a progressive. Right. They identify themselves as a progressive, maybe, and they have a view on what a progressive is. And so that gave the individual voters an opportunity to think about the election a year out in ways in which they would likely conceptualize it. So Democrats could be, there's right now, what we could either have, like, a moderate perhaps, or a more progressive Democrat. That certainly was the case in 2018. There was a fight between those two factions. And on the Republican side, there's almost certainly going to be a contest between a Republican like Larry Hogan and a Republican like Donald Trump. And it's clear from our polling, there is a path to victory for Republicans, and it is not through Trumpism.
Yeah. And thank you for clarifying that. You know, you and I, as political geeks, so to speak, understand it a little differently. But yeah, the reality is, it's how an individual identifies and their perception of what the titles mean. I was a bit shocked, and maybe that's me being way down in the weeds. If I'm not mistaken, on one of the crosstabs, progressives gave Larry Hogan a pretty high mark in job approval. And I thought that that was a bit shocking, because it feels like that is the demographic that has the least faith in the current governor. So I did find that a little shocking, if I'm correct in what I was reading.
I'll take a closer look at the crosstabs, but I will tell you that progressives give the governor the worst marks among moderates and conservatives. So, you know, while the governor does, he does certainly better than other Republicans nationwide in their respective states. He's, I mean, with this sort of sustained approval rating, you're going to have to pull from a different, you know, different subgroups. But that being said, he does much better among conservatives and moderates than he does among progressives. But that is probably what makes Hogan interesting and an interesting figure politically, is the fact that he has been able to sustain approval ratings among the state's Democrats above 50% for most of his time in office. And that's an anomaly. And that is also what makes the Hogan coalition for the next Republican running, if they would like to try to best their Democratic opponent, it makes it a difficult thing to reassemble that kind of support from Democrats, translating that into votes in the general election. It's a different world than in Maryland than it is in even Virginia, who just recently elected a sort of businessy, Trump light adjacent sort of Republican.
Which is also interesting because Trump did not stump for that gubernatorial candidate at the time. And he ultimately crossed the finish line in first place. And some say, was it because Trump didn't come there, didn't get on, wasn't able to get on Twitter at least and say anything? Or was it just the politics of Virginia? And will, you know, how will Maryland play out when it comes to that? Will that have an impact? So it will certainly be very interesting about that and see if the whole Trumpism has a play here in Maryland. But again, the poll is quite clear in Maryland that is not the type of Republican Marylanders would be likely to vote for. And you need Democratic support as a statewide Republican to win. And that's not the crossover appeal. So, but I did find interesting as well in the poll, in the governor's approval rating, at least, the support among Black voters, very high. I think it was 70%. And, you know, there was talk, of course, in the Twitterverse, surprising. I wasn't quite surprised because I had been seeing it. Did any results shock you as a pollster, if you can say?
No, it's not. This isn't really surprising, especially after 6.5 years. So there's nothing about like Hogan's sustained approval rating that surprises me anymore. I will. But the fact that Black voters are, I mean, if you look at the margin of error, they're indistinguishable from white voters. And I guess that certainly is a story given that Hogan is a Republican. And we know that historically, Black voters are heavily aligned with the Democratic Party. But they're also not progressives. And so Hogan certainly has messaged himself, and this is a debate whether he is or not. And we can get into that, I guess, I suppose. But whether he is a moderate, that's beside the point. He has messaged himself as a moderate, and a lot of folks believe that he is a moderate, or they believe that he is a pragmatist, or he's not an ideologue. Whatever those kind of things are, there's certainly an appeal, and a lot of Black voters identify themselves as moderates as well. They are not as progressive as white Democrats, and there might be some sort of ideological cohesion that Black Marylanders see towards Hogan, or they're just satisfied with the job he's doing. He's talking about issues in which they care about. And in that aspect, like, Black voters aren't a monolith, and Black voters are driven by pocketbook issues just like white voters are. The difference being that Black voters are just heavily identified with the Democratic Party. Now, there's a lot of scholars on race and politics who could give you a far better explanation than I could. Right. Folks like Tasha Philpott, there is a Cheryl Laird at University of Maryland. These are all people who could really tell you about Black political behavior in a way that I am just out of my element. But I will say, in Maryland, Hogan's approval ratings among Black residents have been consistently good during his time in office. This is not an anomaly.
Right. So let me switch gears just a little bit as we continue to talk about polling with Dr. Cromer from Goucher College. It's interesting because you do have some pollsters that probably give polling not the best name because they're known as a conservative pollster or they lean a certain way. And I don't know if that's fair if you're just trying to do it the right way, but tell me about some of these push polls that we know could be used for the wrong reason. And people are going to hear about this stuff and they're going to try to be swayed by that. So can you just talk about that? Probably is the bane of your existence and you probably smack your kids on the hand if they ever bring it up in class, huh?
Well, no, listen, here's the action. That's a great question, but let me do, I think, a clarifying point for the audience. Mm-hmm. So there's folks like me who are what you would consider a public pollster. So I run a poll that is made for public consumption. So our goal isn't to inform a candidate or a campaign. Our goal is to take a snapshot of what the public wants or is thinking about for the public good. And a lot of other pollsters that are academic based, like Monmouth, like Marist, like Quinnipiac, are doing the same thing. Now, at the same time, we're in the field sort of trying to figure out where the race is at. Candidates hire their own polling firms. And these individuals are message testing, trying to figure out what messages that will best move the public in their direction. They're interested in who's up and who's down in the race. You know, they use these polls for that they demonstrate viability for fundraising. So we all live in this larger sort of ecosystem. The difference is our goal as a public pollster is to transparently show the whole picture to the public. You only see candidate polls when it's something that can tell a positive story about the candidate. Now, that being said, candidate polls are great. These are high quality, fantastic pollsters who are excellent at their jobs. As a matter of fact, if you look at the New Jersey race, you have a lot of Republican pollsters who are incredibly frustrated, and they should be, at public pollsters like such as me, because their numbers have really shown a much closer race between the Republican candidate and the eventual winner, the Democratic Governor Murphy. And at the same time, a lot of these public pollsters showed that the race was Murphy up 8, Murphy up 11. So it was a clear miss. Mm. So this is it's an uncomfortable ecosystem that oftentimes we all live in. Public pollsters even when we're right, and I would argue that I've been right thus far at Maryland more than I've been wrong, we disrupt sometimes the narrative that campaigns are trying to tell. And that's tough for a campaign pollster because the media is always going to be predisposed to want to use our numbers because we're transparent and we have a public facing mission versus their numbers because their goal is ultimately to get the person elected. And right. So that's really the tension. It's not so much the push polls versus us. Like push polls are just basically unscientific mess. When you're not really trying to gauge public opinion, like you're just calling as many people as you possibly can to push out a particularly negative message about somebody else. Push polls are not really for gauging public opinion. The real tension lies between public pollsters and the folks who do campaign polling.
So audience, if you want to get under Dr. Cromer's skin, tag her in a Twitter poll and say, look at my poll, Dr. Cromer. These are the results of it, because that's an unscientific poll, because you don't have any sort of demographics or anything. You just have random people. So that sounds like idea of that. But yeah, that happened to me. I got smacked on the hand for that because that's just the fun poll of sorts, just to go out and get an opinion of what people who follow you or get a hold of that are. No,
go ahead. TJ, let me clarify that as well. And so what you're talking about, I think this is really important. Public officials as well as public agencies and entities desperately want to know what the public thinks. Mm-hmm. The problem is that public opinion polling is incredibly expensive. And so your average agency, right, the state government doesn't have $40,000 lying around to do a poll on scooter use in Baltimore City. Like that is a large expenditure to figure out like what the average Baltimorean thinks about scooter use. And so because they still want to be data driven, they oftentimes will create these sort of online polls send them out via email, send them out via social media, and they're able to glean, you know, sometimes several thousand respondents. The problem is that it creates a, there's no sampling frame, and that creates a huge self-selection bias that individuals who care about scooters are more likely to take the poll than other people. And what happens is those numbers then get translated into fancy reports, and those reports get shown to elected officials as if they were the same sort of scientifically grounded data as what people like me at the Goucher College poll does. And so that's the tension, that not all data is good data. And so we have to be really careful that when we're going out and collecting the opinions of the public, that we're doing it in a way that actually represents the public at large, and not just, we're not just bolstering special interests.
And that's a big deal. And I'm going to transition into something, but I want to go back really quickly for the sake of clarity. So as we look at the polling that people like Dr. Cromer and her crew of students are involved in at Goucher, they take these different sample sizes based on the demographic makeup of Maryland and get a poll together with a specific margin of error, basically saying, if, you know, we polled everybody, this is about what it would be. If we polled the entire group, this is about what it would be. We're in the midst, of course, of the COVID-19 vaccinations now. And just recently, the 5 to 12 or 5 to 11 year olds approval for the different vaccines has come out. And one of the vaccination groups I was reading about, it was the Pfizer vaccine trial. There were 4,647 participants, and they said only 5 had severe adverse events, and none of which were related to the vaccine. Now, I know this isn't polling, but it's similar in that they pull the demographics out to do the testing in order to produce a report. Are you able to talk anything about that as it relates to polling or the demographics, so people can understand that, yeah, you might not get that phone call, you might not be part of that group, but this is how they extrapolate people in order to build the confidence in what they're about to tell you?
Sure. And so listen, I am not the right person to speak about drug trials. I would certainly recommend some, you know, epidemiologists and medical experts. The COVID-19 vaccine, that has given pollsters, though, an important touch point. So oftentimes it's, we actually know, it is a known parameter, what percentage of the adult population has been vaccinated, thanks to the CDC and the folks at Johns Hopkins and even the Maryland Health Department. So we know that actual population parameter. I can tell you that 78% of Maryland adults have been vaccinated. So for pollsters like me, that's a great touch point to have. So we did our poll of Maryland adults, you know, we took a random sample and we actually asked our sample, like, have you been vaccinated against COVID-19? The good news for us is when the data comes back, lo and behold, our sample correctly estimated the percentage of the population that that has been vaccinated. And so that has been a good news for pollsters nationwide who have been doing this work, as well as our statewide polls, that when we're doing these place sort of public health surveys, which are really important in terms of understanding why people aren't getting the vaccine and why people are getting the vaccine, that we actually can check to see if our sample is actually reflective, because we have that real number that we can link to. And honestly, folks who have been doing this sort of work, and I know the horse race gets all the attention, and I know we love to know who's up or who's down, or if a Hogan Republican or a Trump Republican is better. What's been really important over the last year, at least with the pandemic, is pollsters have done this sort of public-facing work by understanding what is driving people, why they're hesitant, why what's stopping them from getting the vaccine, who is getting the vaccine, who isn't. That is all the work of public opinion. And that is why I know pollsters get a lot of flack when they miss elections, but we have done a good job, I think, by and large, of helping us understand this public health crisis.
Yes. Well, thank you for that work. And my final question, because we could talk all day about polling. It's very interesting. How do you guys get funded to do the polling? And how many more polls do you estimate you might do between now and the primary or now in the general?
So we are funded by our endowment. So Sarah Tillman Hughes was a judge. She's also the only woman to ever swear. She's the only one to swear under presidents. So she swore an LBJ on Air Force One after Kennedy was assassinated. She's a Gautier alum. She donated money to the college to start a Center for Politics, and that's who funds us. That endowment funds us. So we're working and hoping over the next year to try to grow that endowment a little bit more through some fundraising, just so we can do more public opinion polls. To this point, the Gautier poll has been a biannual survey. So we do a poll in the fall and a poll in the spring. We are hoping to be able to do at least one additional poll this year, maybe in advance of that Democratic and Republican primary in June, just because those races are so important. But for certain, the next Gautier College poll on policy issues will be released sometime in like late February, early March. That's our typical time schedule. But yes, so we're actively looking for new to do some fundraising to grow that endowment. The good thing is, in terms of our independence, I'm blind to all of that. So I'm always promote like, yes, please donate to the Hughes Center. That would be great. But I don't get to actually see any of that, because we try to keep the full independence of the Gautier College poll.
Right. And to reiterate, you're nonpartisan, and there, as I said in the open, a myriad of issues. We're a Southern state, according to the respondents in this poll.
No, we're a Northern state.
We're Northern state. Yeah, yeah. And that's how I would have probably voted as well, but I didn't get called, so it must be true. I didn't get called, but I would have voted in that majority that we were more Northern state. I don't consider us a Southern state, although people make fun of our accents all the time. But this is really interesting stuff, and I hope more people just take the time to really understand polling and understand what can be gleaned from it. I believe this is a treasure trove of information for any candidate running for office, because realistically, it looks like a moderate candidate, whether it's a Democrat or Republican, is what most Marylanders would be willing to associate with. However, the primary election does deal you a different hand, so there's that. But we'll see a lot of this forthcoming. So I would like to thank my guest, Dr. Malia Cromer of Gautier College. And hopefully all of you learned a little something about polling today, because I certainly did. And thanks to all of you again, as we aim to be more. Until next time, take care.